Welcome to Aspen Leading Edge. I'm Patty Roberts from St. Mary's University School of Law. And today's guests include Nadel Grossman. She is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Law at Marquette University Law School. And Eric Zaks, who is Associate Professor of Law and Faculty Director for the LLM program at Wayne State University School of Law. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to have you both on the podcast, and we'll be talking about the Aspen book you've written together, Contracts in Context, From Transaction to Litigation, the second edition that's hot off the presses. But before then, I wanted to talk a little bit about each of you. Dean Grossman, I'm going to start with you, if you don't mind. And if you would share for the audience your journey to legal education, what experience and skills did you learn before you got to your associate deanship and professor position?
Sure. Well, thanks again, Patty, for having us on. Before I came into academia, I was a lawyer at a large firm practicing in Houston, Texas. I was a transactional lawyer, which I know a lot of people know what that means. A lot of people don't. So rather than work on disputes or any sort of dispute resolution process, I would help my clients engage in business transactions to really fulfill their business goals. So I had a diversified practice. I would help them raise money through either bank loans or equity transactions. So I'd represent them in, you know, drafting disclosure documents and contracts to raise funding. For a period of time, a year and a half, I worked in-house for a client of ours, the IFC, which is part of the World Bank. And so at that client, again, I would represent them in, you know, representing on loan transactions to provide financing for projects in developing countries. So I'm really helping, again, the clients achieve the business objectives. I had worked on, mergers and acquisitions to some extent. So I had a fairly diversified practice doing different types of business transactions to help my clients.
Great. I'm sure that large breadth of experience in transactional work and corporate securities was very helpful to the work that you're doing now at the law school, especially with your contracts text. So Professor Zaks, can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to legal education and what experiences inform your work in teaching contracts?
Sure, thanks, Betty. Similar to Nadel, I also had a transactional background, although I started my practice as a general, in sort of general corporate work, did some work when Sarbanes-Oxley came out. The focus of my practice was in private equity, so leveraged buyouts, and that's a constant grind of contracts. And what I really was interested in is the process of contracting. It seemed to me that there's an interesting dynamic, not only when the contracts are being exchanged between the parties and there's that information sharing or confirming component, but you're doing it for other parties that are really not present. And that's really informed my scholarship. So thinking about why we draft contracts to clue judges in a certain way or to deter particular party behavior after the contract has been formed, if you think about the homeowners during the mortgage crisis, why people weren't walking away from underwater mortgages, right? There are certain provisions you can put in a contract to deter and guide behavior. And to me, that was very interesting and was an area I wanted to further explore. Obviously, much more difficult to do in a full-time practitioner or partner role at a law firm, and really wanted to explore, take the chance and pursue that interest.
Well, I think I'm going to ask you more about the relevance of behavioral and cognitive sciences that you bring to your scholarship and regarding construction of contracts. But before then, I want to ask both of you, what do you say to new professors or professors who teach in areas other than transactional law when they say, wow, that's kind of a, you know, a, that seems to me to be a daunting topic. You know, my background is more litigation focused, or, you know, I'm not sure that I could undertake course prep in the transactional law realm. And what's your advice to those professors?
Sure, I can start on this. So, you know, as Eric said, we were working on sophisticated transactions in our practices, and yet that is really not the expectation of, you know, that you're going to teach 1Ls, those types of terms in the contract, a typical 1L contract course. And so the approach in our book is very fundamental, just like a typical textbook. And yet what it does is just open the door for faculty and students to this concept that contracts are more than just the mandatory law that we are taught typically in a 1L course. The contracts are really just a vehicle for private ordering and creating terms. And so, you know, we feel that this 1L course opens the door to the concept that you want to understand the legal basics that are taught in every 1L course, but there's just capacity for everybody to understand that's really just the basement of what a contract does. It allows for private ordering. And so it doesn't really go a lot into how to do that, just some basics, but I think it's really simple enough for really anybody to understand. And we also have a very strong support teacher's manual with class notes. And we have a set of slides and eye clickers that I think will support someone new to this area and concept of using the contract for private ordering and just creating that theme of that's really what the contract is supposed to do.
And just to elaborate on that a little bit, one of the distinctions with our casebook is you actually walk through the parts of a typical written contract. It's been amazing to us, and one of our frustrations you know, existing materials is that students could get through an entire year of contracts and never have, it will never have seen a contract or understand the parts of a contract, right?
That's crazy, right?
Right. It's just, that's how we teach it. And so we go through very early on, and it doesn't matter if you start with damages or you start with formation, we're going to start with what are the parts of a contract and why do they exist and how do people use them in a very expository, I don't want to say hand-holding, but very plain face. We're not trying to hide the ball. It's not an old school hiding the ball. We're up here trying to figure out what the parts of a contract are for. No, we're going to tell you, and we're going to use it, and we're going to use real life examples and real life contracts so you can see and to think about and to have the discussions. Well, what could go wrong in this relationship, and what kind of provisions could you put in there to protect yourself? Those are real life experiences. I mean, we tell our students after they're done, they are prepared not necessarily to draft the contracts, but they're prepared to ask the right questions. And that's really where we want to get folks. And that, because of that, it should not be intimidating for professors who are, you know, obviously going to be very skilled in understanding expository text and materials and things like that.
So I'm guessing you probably have students come back and say, oh my gosh, this helped me so much when I was just signing my lease or when I bought my car or whatever contract they signed. Please share if that is some of the response that you get, but expand on that and tell us more about the student reaction, because this is a little bit different than their other first year casebooks in their other first year subjects.
Sure. Just for me, anecdotally, I do see that students are able to better draw the connection from the material to what they have engaged in. I mean, you know, it helps them understand location and the terms in their contracts. They say, oh, I see this is a, you know, a covenant, a requirement, something that I have to do or the landlord has to do. And so, you know, they also use, of course, the defenses that they think, well, maybe I can get out of my lease. And, you know, that's taught in most traditional courses. But by and large, that's not what a contract is doing. It's setting out the terms that parties are going to abide by. And I could definitely see they understand that quite well. And Eric Newell, I'll kick it to you more for some broader student reaction.
I mean, so we've done some, you know, extensive polling with our students, and the reaction's overwhelmingly positive. One of the, it's not a drawback, but it's an interesting reaction initially when the class is so different up front, because we are going through the front end of a contractual relationship. We go through due diligence and letters of intent and sort of these pre-contractual relationships that exist in the process and the real life process, not just looking at retrospectively in litigation. And that's not happening in their other classes. So a lot of times they say, oh, you know, our other classes, all we're doing are cases. And that's an approach, but it's very different. So it's intimidating, or even their other contracts classes, other contract sections. It may be, and we warn them up front, look, you're going to hear from other students in their other sections. They're not going to be doing it this way, but here's why we're doing it. And by the end of the term, they're very comfortable, and we do get the students coming back in their second semester or later on saying, I wish we had had that approach in this other class, because I would have been able to make more connections. And students are really eager, really thirsty for how does this play out in the real world? And contracts is one where you really need to work to make it. A lot of classes are losing that front half of the contracts world, the formation and performance part of the relationship. And that's really what we're trying to supplement.
Right. And that also gives us an opportunity to talk about the role of the lawyer and, you know, the professional obligations of the lawyer. So we do talk about professional identity for a transactional lawyer and engaging with the client. So, you know, putting the lawyer into the advisory role throughout the book is role playing. It really gets students engaged, and it allows us to talk about, you know, professional identity apart from just case after case.
As a former clinician, I can tell you that the role playing is an excellent teaching tool, and I'm glad mm-hmm. to hear that you're including that in your book. I know it's one of the connected ebooks with a study center and practice questions. What sorts of things besides role playing will the professors find and the students find in that connected ebook and the teacher's manuals? What additional resources?
With respect to, you know, the supplemental material, as I'd mentioned, we have really just an extensive set of notes. And the book itself is filled with problems. And a lot of the problems are actually call on students to do something like identify drafting errors or draft a provision or advise a client on a term, what you would put in. So the book itself actually has students engage in very active learning. We also, as I said, we have a supplemental set of iClicker slides. And so, you know, each time I teach the class, I use iClicker for various purposes, comprehension, basic analysis. And so we're trying to get students very much engaged in the material to support the connected questions and the like. So I think that just reinforces and supports what we are doing in the classroom.
The other thing that's part of our book is there's a simulation, sort of simulation problems that run throughout the book and that are sort of cumulative projects at the end of each chapter. And one way I utilize those, because of limited class time, I actually, the students are in groups, and one member of each group is required to upload a video of themselves advising the client in response to the simulation problem, and the rest of the group, as well as I, are required to give them feedback, both with respect to the substance of their answer as well as the presentation techniques, and really trying to, and a lot of that, again, is not straight legal analysis. It's not just, here's the rule, and I'm gonna give you the legal analysis. How would you advise the client? What should they do next? What's your sense of where you would go? What questions do you have? And again, that's real life. That's what we do. That's what a transactional attorney does. And really trying to give students as much of that experience as they can, both inside and outside the classroom.
I should note, Eric teaches a class in a two-semester course, and I teach in a single-semester course. So, you know, we have both adapted what material we're able to use. Like, I am jealous he's able to do those types of activities, whereas I have largely switched out to, we have ASP support that meets weekly. And so I work with those, you know, more senior law students in walking through the ongoing simulation.
Well, that must be very helpful to the academic success program. I love the way that you've got this problem based and these simulation problems. You have the students actually acting as transactional attorneys. And one of the reasons that I find that very exciting is because we, of course, are struggling with how will we prepare our students for the next gen bar exam. And I think the casebook that you have outlined will prepare them very well for the next gen bar exam. not just in contracts, but to practice those skills to be able to step into the role of lawyer, I think will be incredibly helpful. Did that help inform the second edition at all?
I don't know if it did. I think it, you know, I think that Eric and I are both aligned with that, you know, mechanism for teaching. And so, you know, seeing the direction of the next gen, I absolutely agree with what you said, Patty, which is I think our book is a very strong tool to prepare students for that type of exam. But that's because in our view, that's really how the material should be taught, right? It's not just memorizing rote rules. It's how you use that to solving the next problem. And so, you know, it was at the back of our minds, but the truth is we didn't really have to change much because that has been our pedagogical approach from the start, which is using the material to solve the next problem.
And tell me about, you know, it's contracts in context from transaction to litigation. Do most contracts courses cover the entire spectrum from transaction to litigation? Or is your book different in that way?
I think that books do cover the law, like formation. They cover the law on contract terms and interpretation, and of course, defenses to enforcement and remedies. But I think it's the way in which we also approach processes at each stage. So, and again, we insert the lawyer and the student playing the role of the lawyer throughout in those stages. So you are not just learning mutual assent, but like, you know, practical application of that and the role that you play in advising your client to enter into or not enter into a contract. And so, you know, we cover basically the similar flow, but again, focusing a lot more on the process of formation. And again, we do focus more on private ordering and the parties, you know, agreeing on terms when and what conduct amounts to assent. And, you know, conduct the terms that they might want to put in even outside of the baseline law. So, you know, much more empowering of the students to imagine themselves as a lawyer and what terms do you put in and what behaviors to undertake.
Right. It's much more about taking the forward-looking perspective than, and the, really that process part that Nadel was talking about. It's really trying to make sure that when we talk about the chronology of a contract, there's a whole lot that was being missed in terms of the process of formation, right? People will talk about, oh, you might cover letters of intent, but really the process of what's going on there and the lawyer's role is missing, but also that forward-looking aspect. And I think that goes for all legal education, right? I think that the way in which it could be approved is making sure we're giving students a whole view, a strategic view, looking forward and not just teaching them a strictly doctrinal approach. I think that would really should go for all courses, but in particular, the transactional courses. Because if you come out of contracts thinking, well, now I know how to analyze a contracts court case, that's part of it, but that's really, in our opinion, that's really a small part of it, given the large amount of private ordering that is contract practice.
So I'm intrigued, Eric, with the idea of considering behavioral and cognitive sciences when you're looking at the construction of contract formation, breach, and enforcement. Can you give us some examples or a couple of examples where your research has found that to be the case? And what sorts of behaviors can you predict, for instance, in these contract issues?
Right. So a lot of it is about policing imbalances in bargaining power, right? And we try to police those in a number of imperfect ways. But one, what I'm interested in is looking at contracts and saying, why is that provision in there? If we know that provision's in the gray area of enforceability, or even we know it's enforceable, why does it appear in there? Well, we know that particularly when there's imbalances in bargaining power, a consumer might be inclined to defer and comply with an otherwise unenforceable contract provision. So at that sort of one end, you have people who are just, I'm going to take it because it's a take it or leave it contract. And even if and that's fine at the formation stage even, but even when I go, if I'm going to contest it, well, you can prevent somebody from trying to contest an unenforceable contract just because you included a provision in there. You may influence the judge.
So a judge assessing whether or not there was voluntary assent, well, you clicked 12 different times, so you must have assented. It must have been knowing assent. That must be meaningful, even though we know there's demographic, there's cohort differences generationally about the meaningfulness of clicking and things like that. So contracts exist not just for this private ordering, but also to influence post-execution and post-dispute parties. And that's just very interesting to me to see how strategically we can really think, if you want to see strategically is a nice way of putting it, perhaps. But also saying you can look at it at the other extreme, right? So we might have sympathy in the consumer context. In the other extreme, we might have a very, given the level of the equal level bargaining power, and we might have we might believe that those cognitive biases are less relevant when there are advisors, when it's a sophisticated transaction, when the parties have the opportunity to walk away, and we might be less likely to excuse a party for making a mistake or, for example, let's say relying on extra contractual representations and claims of fraud might seem more dubious when you're talking about a sophisticated party that could have protected itself better versus a consumer or similarly situated individual.
So before we started, you indicated you're enjoying a semester of course relief due to many, many overloads. Are you working on this research that you're describing now?
I am. It's actually, today I really had focused a lot of my scholarship on consumer contracts, and now I'm looking sort of at the other extreme. One of the books we use in our casebook deals with the ability of a party to disclaim reliance on extra contractual representations and warranties. In other words, to be able to say, whenever you may have represented to me in the past, I acknowledge you may have defrauded me, and I will never make a claim of fraud against you. And examining the reasons why courts may or may not respect that, and the evolving contract practice that sophisticated parties are now utilizing to make sure that they get the benefit of those anti-reliance provisions. We have, for example, people now define what fraud means in their contract. They define who can commit fraud on behalf of a party, right? If you think about a corporate entity, you might have agents all over the place disclosing a lot of information during due diligence in a complex acquisition. I might not want to be on the hook for everything that anybody in my employ has ever said. So should I be allowed by contract to define, to say, hey, your only ability to sue me for fraud will be if I personally committed the fraud, not if any of my underlings committed the fraud and so on. So that's where I'm exploring right now. We'll see how it shaped up. There've been some work in the area, but with the evolution of representations and warranties insurance, so third-party insurance for a breach of a seller's representations and warranties, the definition of fraud, how you disclaim fraud, how you define it, how you describe it is extremely important. So I'm really excited about being able to have some time to work on that.
Great. Well, Nadel, I can understand why you both are excited about the approach taken in your Contracts in Context book. But I wonder if you can tell us, for those who might have been familiar with the first edition, what differences exist in the second edition that people considering adopting it should be aware of?
Sure. Well, I think that we've maybe further refined some of the problems. So I think they're a better fit for some class discussion. We've replaced a few cases that we think strengthen the book. We talk more about professional identity formation, appreciating that is increasingly important to have that experience across the curriculum. We feel that our book actually does quite a bit of that. Again, because we're introducing the role of the lawyer, it allows us to have that type of discussion and have students really reflect on the identity, the qualities that are important to a transactional lawyer. And so we've modified it in those ways, talked a little bit about cross-cultural competencies as well in negotiating with someone of a different culture, ways to be sensitive and that someone might not otherwise think about. So those are some of the key areas.
Well, thank you. Before we conclude, I want to make sure to ask you the question that I ask all my guests, and that is, can you please share with us how you think legal education is going to change in the coming decade. And Nadel, do you want to start?
Sure. I think we're going to see a continued trend towards, you know, practical application through, you know, this trend towards identity formation is really envisioning the role of the lawyer in the practice throughout the curriculum, even in 1L year. And so, you know, that was really one of the motivating factors for us in writing this book. And so I think you're going to see that trend continue. I believe and hope it'll start to impact other 1L courses as well. You'll see not just kind of a litigation role for lawyers in this identity formation. You'll see more of a, I think, a transactional approach as well, because so many lawyers do that type of work. So I think that trend is going to continue. And of course, emphasis on workshops and practical experiences and internships, and integrating more the doctrine with the practice. That will be my prediction.
Danielle gave a fantastically comprehensive answer, and I guess I would just echo, in addition to echoing what she said, I would just say that we'll continue to see students become increasingly sophisticated with respect to entering law school. Right, they're pretty discerning with respect to cost, and I think that we'll continue to see a focus on outcome-based measurements, right, in terms of bar passage, job placement, things like that, which I think are all good things. And I think those sorts of constraints should push law schools in the right direction and to continue to focus on the things that are important for many, if not most, of the prospective students in our schools.
Completely agree. We're going to have to focus much more on outcomes, and as it should be, right? Our students invest a tremendous amount of time and money to embark on their legal education, so they should be ensured some really positive outcomes for that investment. Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us and discussing your second edition of Contracts in Context, From Transaction to Litigation, published by Aspen and hot off the presses, you tell me. You just received it last week, so that's exciting. I hope that our listeners will listen to not only this episode, but other episodes of Aspen Leading Edge, which you can find on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Google, and Spotify. I want to thank you both so much, Dean Grossman and Professor Zaks, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Patty, for hosting this. This is a great opportunity for us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks very much, Patty.